Thank you for tuning in for the December 7th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology, Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Avi Nath, Director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke at the National Institutes of Health, provides an update on COVID-19 vaccines and the use of immunotherapy in neurologic disorders. In this week's feature interview, Dr. Adam de Havenon talks about the existing disparities in the use of intravenous alteplase and endovascular thrombectomy for patients with ischemic stroke in the United States.
Hello and welcome. This is Justin Abutamarco from the Cleveland Clinic Mellon Center, here with our very special guest, Avi Nath, for a discussion on the latest news surrounding the pandemic. Avi is the clinical director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke at the NIH, and we have been so fortunate to have Avi on the podcast throughout the pandemic to help sift through all the latest data and information on COVID-19. Avi's last discussion with us was a special report published on December 22nd and 28th in 2020. Obviously, a lot has changed since that last conversation, so we're excited to talk about the latest recommendations and safety data surrounding the pandemic.
Thank you, Justin, for having me on this podcast. It's a real pleasure, and it's one of my favorite things to do early in the morning when I drive into work. So I keep up with all the past podcasts, and I welcome the opportunity to contribute to it.
We really appreciate that. Well, let's get started with maybe a quick update by COVID on the numbers. I know we were all hopeful that with the vaccination rollout, we would see a reduced burden on our healthcare systems. But I know at our hospital, as I'm sure many others, the ICU and wards have been at capacity for the last few months. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, Justin. So, you know, this is the worst pandemic mankind has really faced. And we're still living in the midst of a pandemic, although oftentimes we behave as though it's long past. Just in the United States, we've had over 45 million people who are infected with the virus. And those are official numbers. And the official number for deaths exceeds 700,000 in this country. And the unofficial numbers are probably much higher. And so wouldn't be surprised if those numbers are coming close to a million. I certainly hope that as the vaccinations are being rolled out and more people are vaccinated, the trend will continue to keep going down. I know it's possible. And I know everybody's trying hard. So hopefully we'll get there soon.
No, I appreciate the kind of positive message at the end, but those numbers are truly sobering and difficult to get your mind around. Can we talk about any updates on neurological events related to COVID-19 infection? I think we're all familiar with the loss of taste and smell associated with an active infection, maybe encephalopathy that's commonly seen in our ICU patients. But are there other neurological sequelae that clinicians should be aware of? And do we understand any of the mechanisms behind those symptoms?
Yes, Justin. So broadly, the neurological complications can be divided into three categories. You have the acute complications, and you mentioned loss of smell as being a prominent one. But hospitalized patients with COVID can suffer a variety of neurological complications, including strokes, which can be large vessel occlusion or microhemorrhages. And then they can also develop cortical vein thrombosis, and then a lot of secondary organ damage, because multiple organ systems can get involved. So once you get past the acute phase itself, and then in the subacute phase, there are a number of immune syndromes that seem to show up. So individuals can present with Guillain-Barré syndrome, with acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, and a small subset of individuals can even develop acute hemorrhagic encephalopathy. And the pathophysiological mechanisms of each one is very different, and hence they have to be treated very differently. For example, acute necrotizing hemorrhagic encephalopathy is largely cytokine-mediated, so they would be treated with anti-IL-6 or anti-IL-1 antagonists. The ADEM is T-cell-mediated, and Guillain-Barré is antibody-mediated. So the treatment of each one of those has to be different, but it's no different than if they were to occur with any other kind of infectious process. I should also mention in children, you can get another immune-mediated syndrome that's called MISC, or multi-inflammatory syndrome that affects multiple organ systems, including the brain. And there are also immune-mediated therapies, if instituted early enough, can make a difference. But it can be quite devastating in children. And then lastly, you have a whole host of chronic symptoms that develop in patients. Most of them had mild disease early on, and then after several days or weeks can present with a constellation of symptoms. And they can be broadly divided into four categories. Collectively, they've been called long-haul COVID or long COVID. And some present with exercise intolerance. So they get fatigued very easily with little amounts of exercise. And there's some that develop dysautonomia and will complain of tachycardia upon standing or will even fulfill the criteria for POTS. And then there's another subset of individuals who complain of cognitive dysfunction, as well as psychiatric manifestations, which would be first episode of psychosis or first episode of severe anxiety or depression. And the cognitive difficulties have been described by patients as brain fog. And but what they really mean is they have difficulty with concentration, with gathering their thoughts, or remembering things. And then lastly, there are a variety of pain syndromes that can occur in this patient population as well. And they overlap with fibromyalgia, but they can get a burning pain in their feet, suggestive of small fiber neuropathy, or chest pain, or pain in the muscles of the neck, and so on and so forth.
Now, I appreciate that breakdown to kind of simplify those pieces. You know, in particular with those long-haul COVID, I know we're just starting to scratch the surface of trying to understand that disorder, but is there anything that we can share with patients when faced with those clinical scenarios?
Not everyone who presents with these chronic symptoms is necessarily all due to COVID. So the first thing one needs to do is to determine if there's an underlying cause that can explain that. If the patient was admitted in a hospital, maybe they developed some kind of end organ damage that they weren't aware of. Maybe they have an underlying immune disorder that may be presenting this way. So I think those are the first two things one needs to exclude. And then there's a lot of symptomatic treatment that can be provided to patients. There's depression that needs to be treated, the cognitive difficulties, we need to provide them cognitive rehab, pain needs to be treated adequately. So once that is also in place, then I think the best thing to do is to enroll patients into some kind of a clinical study. Most major centers are now developing these long-haul clinics, which are multidisciplinary clinics. And so it'd be good to take advantage of those opportunities. And there is also the ability to then study them more extensively to try and understand what the underlying pathophysiological mechanisms might be. And they're in the best place to even try empirical therapies for these patients. Our current thinking is that likely they are immune-mediated syndromes. So if so, then some sort of empirical therapy could be tried. But it needs to be done under the watchful eye of a researcher or a clinician.
No, absolutely. I like that idea of enrolling in clinical trials. I think that gives the patient also some reassurance that, you know, we're actively looking into this. And I think there'll be a lot more to come on this topic. You know, now that we're almost a year into the vaccination rollout, can we talk a little bit about the latest safety data we've seen with the vaccines? I just want to quickly highlight that there was an October 18th podcast with Dr. Thacker, where she reviewed in detail neurological adverse events associated with a COVID-19 vaccination. So maybe we could speak a little more broadly on that topic. For example, I know we just saw a few countries in the European Union, including Sweden and Denmark, that halted the Moderna vaccination in males under 30 due to some concerns for myocarditis. Can you share any information on the overall safety profile related to these vaccines?
So yeah, absolutely right. Each of these vaccines has been associated with some side effects. That's not surprising. You know, every vaccine, every medication, whatever you have, will have some kind of side effects. So these vaccines do too. But having said that, these vaccines are actually very safe. So most of the complications are in small numbers of individuals. And I believe that a number of them are actually treatable if one intervenes early enough in the process. As you might recall, with the AstraZeneca vaccine, it was first halted because there were two individuals who developed multiple sclerosis-like symptoms. And then later, there were a whole host of individuals who developed cerebral venous thrombosis. And now there have been reports of the vaccines that have been associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome. And you're right about the myocarditis aspect as well. So if you look at the VAERS database, which is the database managed by the CDC, and it's a place where any patient who experiences any kind of side effect can go in there, patient or physician, and can enter in their data. So the advantage is that it captures everything. The disadvantage is it captures more than what it should, which means that there's no way of verifying the authenticity of the data. And there can be multiple entries on a single individual as well. So, but with that caveat, if you look at it, there are a wide variety of complications that people have reported, from death to strokes to transverse myelitis to optic neuritis to tinnitus, a lot of the loss of hearing, vertigo, peripheral neuropathies, dysautonomia. So you name it, you can find all these categories of potential side effects. But you also have to put the denominator in perspective, because the number of people vaccinated, even in just United States, more than 200 million people have been vaccinated already. So if you have a few thousand people, let's assume, that develop these side effects, it still amounts to, in a sense, it looks like a lot, but if you look at the percentages, that actually is pretty rare.
No, I think putting that in that perspective is so important. It can be challenging one-on-one with a patient, but I think that's part of our roles as clinicians when we talk with patients, to highlight those kind of safety pieces. So thank you. I think moving on, and I think it's a question on everyone's mind, what is the latest from the FDA and CDC regarding the COVID booster shots? Do you have any thoughts or guidance that we can share with our listeners?
Yeah, so that's a very, very important question, because it's very confusing. The guidelines are just as confusing. So let's look at it this way. You know, if you look at a number of vaccines, for example, the polio vaccine, diphtheria vaccine, hepatitis vaccine, they all are three dosages. Okay, and the reason for our three dosages is that the first two dosages just prime the immune system. And it's the third dosage that gives you long-term immunity. But I think unless we all get three dosages, we won't really have long-term immunity. So I think ultimately the population is going to need three doses.
Right, that's really interesting. And that historical perspective and that third dose for some of those other infectious diseases also really kind of interesting and does put it into perspective. Maybe we can talk about how to approach those booster shots with patients on different immunotherapies. You know, I know as a neuroimmunologist, this is one of the more challenging aspects in my clinic. Maybe we could break the topic down into like some commonly frontline employed immunotherapies versus long-term immunotherapies. We can start with the corticosteroids. I think most providers try to avoid vaccinations while treating with high-dose steroids. But should we consider all patients on chronic daily prednisone immunocompromised? For example, a myasthenic patient on prednisone 5 milligrams daily, should they be recommended to have a booster shot?
Yeah, small dosages of prednisone don't really affect the immunity in response to an infection or a vaccine at all. So I think 5, 10, 20 milligrams should be no problem. Higher dosages, yes, you will impair the immune response. But if you just think about the general principle of immune suppressive drugs, and if you're giving them periodically, let's say, you know, anti-B-cell therapy or what have you, and so you give the drug, and it takes a little while to have its maximal effect and then starts losing its effect, and then you give it again. So what you want to do is you want to time the vaccine by when you are spaced between the two dosages and closer to the dosage that you're going to give, so that you need at least 2 weeks to get a 10 to 14 days to get an adequate response from the vaccine dose. So if you can have the opportunity, once you give the booster, that have minimal immune suppression for that period of time and time the interval between the dosages accordingly, then I think you're good. But if you cannot, you still give the booster, you still get some immune response. And in fact, even if you're comparing B cells, you'll still get a T cell immune response, which may actually still be very good. So I would immunize people even if they were on immune suppressive therapy.
I like that general kind of recommendation to give people 10 to 14 days to kind of have that optimal response to the vaccine is a good general guideline.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you keep that principle in mind, then you can work through whatever immune suppressive regimen that you're giving to the patients.
And I think you already mentioned a little bit with the B cell depleting agents such as rituximab. So trying to give it before their infusion, is there an optimal time frame if that's not possible? So how long should we wait until after their infusion to give them that booster shot?
Yeah, so my guess is if you give the booster shot and if you can wait at least the maximal effect of an anti-B-cell therapy, you know, most of these things start binding almost immediately and they'll start depleting B-cells over a month. So if you can wait at least a month or so and then give it, I think you'll be fine.
Perfect. And I think another question, since a lot of neurologists will use IVIG in their practice, is how to time the IVIG infusions into COVID booster shots. Is there any guidance for how that should be done?
So IVIG is usually not a concern. So for example, there's been a lot of discussion with that with regards to the flu vaccine. And it's been shown that you can give the flu vaccine at the same time as you give the IVIG, even you give it together, you can still get an adequate response to the flu vaccine. So IVIG doesn't really suppress the immune system, it modulates it. And so I think it's safe to give it at any time during an IVIG infusion. And but the only thing theoretically one could argue, and I'm not even sure that that's even much of a concern, is that currently the IVIG probably does not have antibodies to SARS-CoV-2, because a lot of this was prepared, quite in advance. But as we are vaccinating the large numbers of the population, eventually the IVIG will also have antibodies to SARS-CoV-2. So you can make a theoretical argument that at some point, is it possible that the antibodies in the IVIG could block the immune response from the vaccine itself. But the titers may not be that high to really make that much of a difference. I don't know that for sure.
All right. Well, I think it sounds like it's pretty safe to give the vaccination while patients are getting the IVIG infusion, which is helpful because it's already a challenge to get our patients vaccinated and get these booster shots administered.
Give it when you can.
Right, exactly. Maybe we could talk lastly about other long-term oral immunotherapies, such as those employed in multiple sclerosis, like S1P modulators, i.e. Gilenya. And we could extrapolate out those recommendations for other oral medications commonly used in practice, like mycophenolate or azathioprine.
So the same principle would apply here as well. I think no matter what drug you are taking, just try to see when is the maximal effect of the drug and try to avoid that period or time frame from giving the vaccine. And once you're past that, just make sure you have at least 10 to 14 days before you institute the next dosage of the drug. Now, if you have to take a drug every day, then just try to see if you can get away with the lowest dosage possible and that you can control the patient with, and then vaccinate them. And then you can go back to a higher dosage if necessary. But I wouldn't say that recommend that you take them off and they need the drug for treatment. You should keep them on that.
Well, Avi, I can't thank you enough for your time today. In addition to all your other work on COVID-19 related projects, I think this is a really challenging topic to stay current on, and we really appreciate your efforts to summarize the latest data and provide some perspective on this, historic pandemic.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Justin. It was a real pleasure. Stay safe.
This is Andy Sutherland from the University of Virginia. And for this week's Neurology Podcast, I'm very pleased to be speaking with my friend and colleague, Adam Dehavenon, from the Department of Neurology at Yale University. We're going to be discussing an article published in this week's issue of Neurology titled, Acute Ischemic Stroke Interventions in the United States and Racial, Socioeconomic, and Geographic Disparities. In this study, Adam and colleagues analyzed data from the 2016-2018 National Inpatient Sample regarding the proportion of acute ischemic stroke patients who received TPA, or endovascular therapy. Adam, as you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about disparities in acute stroke intervention over the years. We did an interview back in 2018, I believe, by your co-author, Jenny Majerzyk, with Scott Mendelson about racial disparities in the use of IV TPA. And then back in 2016, we did an interview with Steve Massey, looking at TPA data from the Get With The Guidelines database from 2003 to 2011. So obviously, this is a more up-to-date data analysis, but what does this most recent study from 2016-2018 suggest about modern trends and disparities in acute stroke treatment?
Great question, Andy. And as you noted, this, of course, has been a topic of research really since TPA became a accepted treatment for stroke going back, 20 years at this point. But over time, of course, there have been significant changes in the utilization of both TPA and endovascular thrombectomy. For example, in this somewhat limited series of years of data from 2016 to 18, We see TPA use increase from 8% to over 10% of patients, and an even more dramatic increase in endovascular thrombectomy from a little under 3% to about 5.5%. So it is important to, over time, look and see that as these interventions become more common, are the disparities that have been previously noted still present? Or did the increase in utilization address the disparities? And that was the primary driver of our analysis. The secondary driver was that in 2016, it became possible to accurately adjust for or take into account the severity of the stroke in the national inpatient sample. Medicare introduced a billing code that lets researchers take out the NIH stroke scale from these administrative data sets. And that's something that in previous analyses hasn't been done. And as you can imagine, stroke interventions like TPA and endovascular thrombectomy are highly influenced by the severity of stroke because of their risks.
Well, and Adam, I thought that was one of the really interesting parts of this analysis was the inclusion of NIH stroke scale data, which for all the neurology listeners out there who take care of stroke patients, you know, recognize what you just mentioned, which is that a lot of these decisions about treatment and differences in utilization will rely in large part on the severity of the stroke. And so as you look at the data and you know, and the overall sort of increased utilization, you know, can you just talk a little bit about some of the disparities that you found in the multivariable analysis? And then specifically, I'm curious, you know, if some of these disparities are truly independent of one another. For instance, is a race-ethnic disparity independent of income or insurance status, or is a geographic disparity independent of socioeconomic status? Can you delve into that a little bit for us?
Sure. The first thing that became apparent when I looked at the 2016 to 18 data was that a previously documented disparity between men and women, namely that women were less likely to receive acute stroke interventions over time. And in this data set, that is no longer apparent. And that's an interesting phenomena because it does show that a disparity that has been documented going on 15 years has now effectively been addressed. And we can't, of course, answer the why of that. We don't know what has led to the more recent data set here not showing a sex-based disparity. But it is important because it shows us that these disparities are not intractable. They can change and certainly do. However, disparities that have been shown as well in older data sets specific to race, ethnicity, patient location, in other words, if they're living in a major metropolitan city all the way down to a rural community, and then income by zip code, those disparities have persisted, unfortunately. We certainly, looking at a national data set like this, do see a lot of complexity. So, for example, in southern states, there might be more of an overlap between location and race ethnicity than there would be in, say, the Intermountain West, in Wyoming, Colorado, et cetera. But you are correct that, you know, there is collinearity between some of these. And really, what we're talking about here are social determinants of health. And obviously, self-identified race is a construct and one that overlaps considerably with both where you live and how much income a household is likely to have in that specific area. So it is complex, Andy, but we don't really delve into those interactions in this analysis. We focus more on sort of the broad categories that I was talking about before, and still find these disparities, as I mentioned before, which are troubling, of course. You and I both treat acute stroke patients, and it worries me to think that patients based off their specific race, ethnicity, location, or income may be less likely to receive a treatment with proven benefit like TPA or endovascular thrombectomy.
No, I couldn't agree more, Adam. I think it's, you know, this data, while enlightening, I think is certainly, you know, troubling from that standpoint. And, you know, in a moment, we'll sort of consider that at the broad level. You know, sort of finishing off with the analysis, however, you mentioned in your discussion in the paper some of the important confounders that aren't included in the data. I think it's important to recognize some of that when it comes to interpreting the results and generalizability. Can you speak to that aspect?
Sure. In general, large administrative data sets, such as the National Inpatient Sample, are not as granular as a registry, where you might have things like the size of the stroke on neuroimaging, contraindications to TPA or endovascular thrombectomy. And there's a long list of contraindications for TPA, a separate but equally detailed list for endovascular thrombectomy. So you can't really get at if there were other things to explain these findings.
So sort of taking it to then to that next step, Adam, big picture, you know, overall the data suggests we're making progress in utilization of acute stroke treatment. That's great. And perhaps even closing the gap between the disparity by sex, between treatment utilization in men and women, which of course is really encouraging, as you said, to sort of suggest that perhaps we can move the needle on some of these disparities, but these big public health issues remain based on race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, geography. I'm going to allow you to pontificate for just a moment here and understanding that, as you said, we really can't get to the why in the data, but how do you think, just as someone who really has had a good look at this data set, how do you feel we can best close this gap going forward? And from a research point of view, what are the steps that we need to better understand these disparities going forward?
Great question, Andy, and I wish I had a more impactful or actionable answer. Taking the perspective as a clinician, that certainly bothers me because I know from my experience that these are beneficial treatments and everyone who is eligible should be able to get them. But healthcare is far more complicated than that. And particularly in the United States, with a large geographical area, resources that are concentrated in rural areas and in particular in more socioeconomically advantaged rural areas, it is difficult to provide the same level and availability of care in a country like this. But I do think that we should continue to strive to achieve that. These are not simple questions. These disparities are persistent and beyond what we can answer with administrative data sets. So that gets at work that needs to be done really with a focus not just on simple things like how severe the stroke was at admission to the emergency department, but things like, are there language barriers? Are there cultural barriers, educational gaps? Is insurance status playing a role? Is systemic beliefs within the medical profession playing a role? These are not things that you can capture easily, but there are researchers doing that kind of work in an ongoing fashion. And I think that for stroke, it is time to start another prospective longitudinal study where we look at social determinants of health and both the impact on acute treatments for stroke, but also the follow-up. How do these social determinants of health impact recovery and stroke recurrence? I haven't heard of a large-scale effort of that sort, but I am hopeful that one will be forthcoming.
I agree with you completely and hope that we can be part of this in our time of seeing a prospective study of that magnitude and the implementation measures that need to occur, as you rightly pointed out, to better educate not only our patients about stroke, but also our providers about our patients as well. And optimistically, I hope that we get to do this podcast again in you know, perhaps 2026, 2028 national inpatient sample data, and we can say that we've closed the gap on some of these disparities further, or however long it takes. So with that, perhaps we'll wrap up there, Adam. I just want to commend you and your co-authors again on this paper. I'll ask our listeners, definitely go seek this out in the Neurology Journal. There's so much more information out there that we didn't have time to discuss, but look for the article titled Acute Ischemic Stroke Interventions in the United States and Racial, Socioeconomic, and Geographic Disparities. Adam, thanks so much again for joining us.
Thank you, Andy.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article investigating the frequency of neurologic manifestations in patients with COVID-19, as well as a global study estimating life expectancy for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy at different ages. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.